Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What lies ahead for the people of Syria as they deal with the aftermath of apparent chemical attacks on a neighborhood outside Damascus? The most conservative accounts put the death toll at over 100, while opposition leaders say it may be well over 1,000 men, women, and children. Many suspect the embattled regime of President Bashar al-Assad is behind the attacks, although the regime has denied it. And today, French and Turkish leaders are among those calling for international intervention if a link to the Syrian government can be proven. My guest this hour is in a unique position to comment on the likelihood of Assad's involvement, as he may know the Syrian president better than any other Western analyst. David W. Lesh is professor of Middle East history at Trinity University. His book, Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad, has been newly updated following initial publication last year and is now available in paperback. David Lesh joins us from the studios of Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. David, welcome to Think.
Well, pleasure to be here.
Have you been able to speak with any of your contacts in Syria since news broke of the apparent chemical attacks?
No, I have not. It's hard to maintain contact with a number of the people in the regime that I used to know, particularly since many of them have left or defected. But I have not heard anything from any of my contacts in the opposition either.
Would you mind sharing your sort of personal response when you heard this news?
Well, it's you know, as one opposition leader told me about a few months ago, when the first reports started to filter in about chemical attacks that may or may not have been carried out by the regime, you know, he said, 100,000 of us have been killed by conventional weapons. A couple of hundred of us maybe have been killed by chemical weapons. So why hasn't the world taken notice? With 100,000 versus the couple of hundred. And so when I hear this, I think of many of those in the opposition who I've come to know, and those on both sides who are suffering under this tremendous tragedy, that, you know, it's become almost another footnote of another day of tremendous loss, because I don't think, based on initial reports, that it will galvanize any sort of international response, despite the call for such a response by some countries.
You think it won't galvanize a response because it is too sort of politically risky for the countries that might have an investment in doing this?
Yeah, that's part of the reason. I mean, part of the reason is simply trying to prove chain of custody, and in terms of proving, in fact, that the Syrian government carried out these attacks. It on the surface, it doesn't make any sense for the Syrian government to do this, because tactically speaking, it really provides no advantage on the battlefield, and more often than not, it harms those using the chemical weapons and those who they're aimed against. But it does have a psychological element to it. It could also be attempts by the Syrian government, if they are doing this, or by In fact, perhaps the Iranians, who have a great deal of influence in Damascus, to test the so-called red lines that the West, and particularly the United States, have laid down regarding chemical weapons.
Talk about the effect of this kind of recrimination on the resolve of the opposition in Syria. Is this likely to sort of spur greater outrage, or could it possibly act as a deterrent to dissident activity?
I don't think it will act as a deterrent. It may galvanize somewhat, but again, you know, they've been dealing with these types of death tolls for some time now. When the West cries out, or, you know, with such a chemical weapons attack, I can certainly hear some of my opposition contacts say, they just shrug their shoulders and say, okay, fine. There's a lot of bark, but no bite, and they kind of understand that they are on their own on this, despite, again, all the protestations from the West. Unless, again, this is something of a totally different order in terms of thousands of casualties that can be proven. That may prove to be something of a game changer.
I'd like to step back for a moment here and talk about how you happen to be in the unique position you are to know Bashar al-Assad rather intimately, or to have known him rather intimately. Talk about how you first secured interviews with him and how sort of that relationship grew as you continued your research.
Well, as an academic and a specialist on the Middle East, and particularly on Syria, I have been traveling to Syria on a regular basis since the late 1980s. And again, as an academic, I usually made quite a bit of contacts and indeed strong friendships with a number of Syrian academics. And when Bashar al-Assad came to power, he had been for several years before that, when he came to power in 2000, he had been chair of the Syrian Computer Society, which had as its, in its kind of executive council, many academics. And some of those people were good friends of mine. And when he became the president of Syria in 2000, upon the death of his father, he brought many of these academics and other technocrats into the government, including some of my friends. And it was one of the reasons why a number of people thought, well, maybe he could be different, that he's bringing in people who have a different outlook on society and culture, foreign policy, the economy, et cetera. And therefore, people had great hopes in that. One of the people he brought in was, in fact, a good friend of mine that I contacted in 2002 and said, look, this president has such an atypical background and rise to the presidency because he was a licensed ophthalmologist, because he was not groomed to be the president for some time, and because he wasn't expected to be president. His older brother was expected to be president until he died in a car accident in 1994, and all of a sudden Bashar was brought back from London where he was engaged in advanced study in ophthalmology to then groom him for the presidency. So it was a very atypical background, and so I was very interested in learning about him and his outlook on life and on society and where Syria should go and all of these things. And then 2 years after that, in 2004, I finally received the green light to interview him. And I interviewed him extensively in 2004 and continued to meet with him at his request until 2009.
In the earliest encounters, what was his demeanor like?
Well, he was very, unpretentious, unprepossessing, very, humble type of individual. And certainly not the authoritarian autocrat or murderous thug image that, many people have of him today. And most people who met him, during these early years, had the same impression. He was very gregarious, very welcoming, had some interesting insights on the future of Syria. Again, all of this led people to think that he may be different than his taciturn, stern, father had been. He was more interested in public diplomacy than his father was, who really didn't even understand what the word meant. He was just, as I said earlier, atypical, different from the usual caricature of the Middle East tyrant.
You say here that, perhaps there was always a bit too much hope placed in this new government, this new leader that was Bashar al-Assad. Was that hope shared in Syria as well and not simply outside the country?
Well, no, there was a lot of hope in Bashar al-Assad. And again, I think the expectations were too great, and particularly so maybe in the West. I think probably they were a little bit more measured in Syria because they understood in Syria how slow the system works, how hard it is to change the system. Whereas in the West, attuned to these, 4-year terms, particularly in the United States, the attention span of a soundbite, they want change very, very quickly. And so I think the disappointment in the West was more pronounced. And I remember the first meeting I had with Bashar al-Assad in 2004, after the pleasantries were exchanged, after I explained what I wanted to do. I told him, Mr. President, one of the worst mistakes you made upon becoming president in 2000 was letting it be known that you like Phil Collins music, the famous rocker, British rocker. And of course, he looked at me in a very strange manner. But I explained that, this fed into this profile in the West that you are this, pro-Western modernizing reformer because he went to school in London for all of 18 months, because he was an ophthalmologist, because he liked Western music and was something of a computer nerd and liked the technological toys of the West. Everyone thought that he would, be this different type of leader. And what I was, you know, what I used to tell people during that time back in the United States and elsewhere is that in some ways, yes, that's true. But, you know, remember who he really is. You know, he's a child of the Arab-Israeli conflict. He's a child of the superpower Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union. He's a child of the tumult and conflict in Lebanon. And most importantly, he's a child of Hafez al-Assad, his mm-hmm. father. You know, these are the most influential factors shaping his worldview. And so I think to expect that, you know, upon coming to power, that he would embrace the West, that he would immediately try to implement democratic reform was expecting way too much. And therefore, the disappointment was that much greater, I think, in the West.
Hafez al-Assad came to power in 1970. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Talk a little bit about the country under his rule and the challenges that he faced and the attempts he made to at least sort of provide a kind of stability.
Well, that you hit upon the key word there, stability. You know, that's the sort of Hobbesian or Faustian bargain that Hafez al-Assad and his leadership gave the Syrian people, because Syria, since formal independence after World War II, had known really nothing but political instability. A number of actual coups and coup attempts, and of course, Hafez al-Assad himself came to power in a coup in 1970. So one of the things that he promised is that, you know, in a sea of instability and conflict in the heartland of the Middle East, that I will provide security and stability, but it will be at something of a price. It will be at a price of certain freedoms and perhaps even provide some economic prosperity at time and economic openings at times. But that's what, you know, he brought to the table, so to speak, and did it fairly well despite many, many stresses. Now, many Syrians would say, well, he did this while implementing a repressive state, an omnipresent intelligence services that made life miserable for many. So there are many different views of this, but I think most Syrians would agree, those who liked or respected Hafez al-Assad and those who did not like him, that he did, you know, come through with that, with his side of the bargain, that he provided stability despite all of the stresses and conflict in that part of the Middle East.
How have Alawites hung on to power so long in a country that is majority Sunni?
Well, it's an interesting story, because the Alawites, of course, an offshoot of Shiite Islam, and they make up about 10 to 12% of the country in Syria, whereas Sunnis make up about 75%, and the rest are a mixture of Christians and Druze and others. The Alawites themselves had been downtrodden and persecuted for centuries in what came to be known as Syria. And under the French mandate after World War I, when the French ruled over essentially what we know now as Syria, they wanted to bring elements of the population into an army that they were constructing. Most of the majority population did not want to participate in this for nationalist reasons, because they did not want to be seen as being co-opted by the French or cooperating with the French. The Alawites, and many of them up in the northwestern part of Syria, again, having been socioeconomically distressed with no real chance of upward social mobility, saw this as an opportunity. And so many Alawites, as well as some Druze and others, entered the military apparatus in the mid-1950s, and from that, they gained political power when Syria gained independence after World War II. So they were well-positioned, and something that they don't want to give up very easily, because they worked hard for it.
My guest is David W. Lesh, professor of Middle East history at Trinity University and author of the book Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. It is newly updated following initial publication last year, and it's out now in paperback. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with David W. Lesh. He is professor of Middle East history at Trinity University and author of Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. He joins us this afternoon from the studios of Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. David, as we discussed earlier, it was not Bashar al-Assad who was his father's heir apparent. His older brother was killed. Was it sort of understood in the family growing up that if something were to happen to Basil, that Bashar would be the one to step in?
As far as I can tell, there was nothing explicitly said along those lines. The narrative coming out of the Assad family and the leadership, certainly after Bashar came to power in 2000, was that it was unexpected, that he was not being groomed. I think clearly from the outside it could be seen that he was being groomed once his brother died in 1994. But I think before that, certainly he had no aspiration or expectation to be president, or in fact to play any sort of prominent role in the government, if in fact his brother lived and did become president. But it's also a cultural thing. I in the Arab world that the older brother passes away or somehow does not take up the mantle of leadership of the family, that the next oldest son will do so. And so in that sense, it could be expected.
What were the early reforms proposed by Bashar al-Assad as president?
Well, he couldn't do much at first. I mean, as in most situations like this, before his father died, it almost seemed to be a race against time for his father to prepare the ground as much as possible for Bashar al-Assad before he, in fact, did die. And it appears that he just barely did that. But having said that, there were a number of so-called, at the time, old guard from his father's longtime reign that were very powerful figures. And Bashar had to establish, his own position and consolidate his own power for several years, before he could really, I think, implement what he hoped to implement. And so at first, he really just, I think, made cosmetic changes, particularly in education and administration and so forth. He really couldn't do anything in terms of the economy in any dramatic sense, and certainly not politically, particularly after, the so-called Damascus Spring, soon after he came to power, which I think was an expression of his own, personal style and what he wanted to implement in Syria. And there was a great deal of unprecedented political openness, certainly under the Assad's unprecedented political openness for a few months. And as Syrian observers will say, that, by early 2001, some of the old guard, particularly in the military security apparatus, you may have knocked on his door and said, look, young man, we don't do that, this type of thing in Syria. Therefore, we need to pull back before we lose our position altogether. And so there was what many have called a Damascus winter and return of the repressive political apparatus that had characterized his father's rule.
Jumping over a decade to the Arab Spring, Assad was taken rather by surprise by the fact that his country ended up falling into the kind of unrest that was happening elsewhere.
He was taken quite by surprise, and this has been confirmed in my discussions with regime officials who are still in the regime that I've talked to in the last couple of years, as well as regime officials who have since defected since the beginning of the uprising, to the point where the Syrian regime was actually supporting the protesters in Egypt and in Tunisia and elsewhere, except for Libya, because Bashar had a relationship with Muammar Gaddafi, and therefore he continued to support the Libyan government. And so it's very, very ironic because they totally misread the causes of the of all of these uprisings. He felt, and the leadership believed in Syria, that because he had been against the United States, because he had continued to oppose Israel or what they call the American-Israeli project in the Middle East, because he was young, 40-something, rather than the octogenarian, leaders of Tunisia and Egypt and elsewhere, in tune with the Arab youth, popular in the Arab street, that Syria was somewhat immune to this. But he misread the situation because, you know, many of the factors that led to the explosions in Egypt and Tunisia and Libya, Yemen, elsewhere, particularly, you know, the youth bulge and the stress that put on the already existing socioeconomic problems in these countries, as well as the extensive corruption, all those things existed in Syria as well. And as many of the Syrian opposition leaders have told me, it would not have happened in Syria unless the Arab Spring occurred first elsewhere, because they saw, you know, look what happened in Egypt, look what happened in Tunisia, where, you know, seemingly, relatively speaking, overnight, entrenched authoritarian regimes or leaders were ousted, were overthrown. Therefore, it can happen in Syria. That's what they thought. Of course, they were wrong in that assessment. It's one of the biggest mistakes that the Syrian opposition, as well as those opposed to the Syrian regime in the West and elsewhere, have made is they've underestimated the lasting power of the Syrian regime.
Well, and the trigger event in Syria is such a sort of bizarre misstep by the administration. Can you remind us of what happened?
Yeah, it was a town in the south of Syria called Daraa, near the Jordanian border. And according to the story, and there are some different versions of this, but I'll give the generally accepted one, is that some school children, teenagers, painted graffiti on walls, essentially saying, down with the regime. Actually, the correct word was down with the system. And the Mukhabarat, the intelligence security services, as they are wont to do in Syria, rounded them up, apparently roughed them up a bit. And the people in Daraa, you know, family members, tribal members, they were very upset at this and started to protest and demonstrate against this. And this was a critical, critical moment in the uprising. Almost every opposition person with whom I have spoken has said if Bashar al-Assad had taken decisive action at that time, his cousin was the governor of Daraa, if he had gone down there and fired him, you know, publicly humiliated him, if he had gone down to Daraa, made a personal visit, made concessions, you know, tried to redress the issue, that it would have died out right then and there. But the regime made a terrible mistake. Bashar, I think, made a mistake in not personally addressing this issue, and in fact went in the opposite direction with his March 30th, 2011 speech, his first public comment on the uprising, when he started blaming terrorists and the external enemies of Syria, instead of really addressing the problems, socioeconomic problems in Syria, and addressing specifically that incident. So it was a real, potentially a fatal misstep by the regime.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also reach us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Thomas in Dallas. Hello, Thomas.
Yeah, what really disturbs me is the cartoonish narrative we've been given about the whole Syrian crisis, which sadly the author sort of repeated. Bashar Assad was torturing al-Qaeda rebels for us. He was never a problem for Israel. And in fact, what you find in the more interesting narrative, I think, is that much of the deep state was very ambivalent or less encouraged to do this, yet I think you had some intrepid people pushing this forward. You had Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf Cooperation Council working to fund and arm these terrorists. Barack Obama said we're doing everything but arming them and doing more, suggesting we were arming them at least indirectly. And so much of that suspect. So many of the whole perspective in the media has been exclusively on the side of the rebels, blaming a car bombing in front of a Russian embassy on Syria and the shooting of 9 police officers in one of the early riots on Syria, which neither of those make any sense. But what we're seeing is the divide between the Gulf Cooperation Council and Saudi Arabia has shown its divide in the support of Egypt. And this is a rift which is far more compelling, more interesting. And again, if you want to know what the minorities support, women have more rights in Syria than any other country in the Muslim world. They can walk in the front of a mosque. They can't do that in this country.
Well, Thomas, you've given us a lot for David to respond to, so I'm gonna stop you there and give David a chance to speak.
No, very interesting comment. I think the caller hit on something that's a very, very important aspect of this whole conflict. In fact, one high-level European diplomat told me once that there are two wars, and this is a diplomat that from a country that supports the regime. He said there are two wars in Syria. There's the actual war, the actual fighting and dying, and then there's an information war that's being fought in the social media as well as in the newspapers and the internet and so forth. And he said the Syrian government, the Syrian regime, is losing the information war. And that's for many, many reasons. One, there's always, I think the caller is right, and what I in fact do write about this in the book, contrary to what he said, about a generally pro-Western orientation, an anti-Syrian orientation of the press in the West, and there has been a number of stories that have been wrong on both sides of the equation, but. You know, the Syrian opposition groups in particular have played this information war much better than the regime. As I mentioned earlier, you know, Hafez al-Assad, the father, didn't even know what public diplomacy meant. People were calling on him to engage with people, to engage with other countries, and he was very reclusive in that sense. His son, Bashar, was much better, but still, had a long way to go in terms of public diplomacy. The Syrian system just isn't geared for that. And so they have a less of an understanding of the media instruments in the West and how to play these media instruments in their favor. Whereas the Syrian opposition groups, many of whom have been outside of Syria for many, many years and who've been brought up in the Western culture and Western social media and so forth, are much more attuned to how to use these things in order to cull favor and win this information war. So there is a lot of disinformation there. It's very difficult to find out what is true and what is not true, including the reported chemical weapons attacks, which is why I've been traveling around that area and actually went to Damascus in February and meeting with opposition leaders on a regular basis since that time to learn, as much as possible from the sources themselves rather than the media sources, which are so often either misinformed or tainted even to some degree.
Has the makeup of the opposition fallen pretty predictably along sectarian lines?
The makeup of the Syrian opposition is almost wholly Sunni. They'll trot out some Christians or even some Alawites, Druze, in other words, minorities in Syria, to try to put on this front that they are multi-ethnic and multi-religious and so forth. But it is largely Sunni, and it reflects the majority makeup of the population. And for many Sunni Arabs in Syria, it reflects the fact that they feel, for the most part, not totally, but for the most part, they have been dispossessed from the fruits of society and that the most of the largesse from any sort of economic well-being and economic progress in Syria has been disproportionately geared for those who are tied to the Syrian regime, mostly Alawite, but also some Sunni business class families and members. But it really reflects what has been a general disenchantment with the regime and the lack of opportunity for the majority of the people in Syria.
We have an email here from Mike who writes, "History demonstrates that the West does not have the ability to intervene with wisdom in any Middle East country. How can the global community, for example, the UN, influence the outcome of the war without becoming militarily involved?"
Good question. And that's everyone's been looking for an answer to that question because no one really wants to become militarily involved. Certainly the United States does not. Something I actually am not terribly against. I think it's a very dangerous situation in which to become involved, particularly when you don't understand the nature of it as well as they should. And as the person who wrote the email suggests, we haven't done it that well in the past, particularly in the Middle East at a time when we're trying to withdraw from these types of conflicts is not particularly the time when we want to take steps that might lead to another engagement, another Middle East war. Certainly the polls don't suggest that, and the administration's actions suggest they don't want to get any more military involved than they already are. So where is the answer? And it has to be some sort of a political settlement. And many groups and many organizations and many countries have tried to put forth ideas regarding a political settlement. But the bottom line is you need willing parties on both sides, and you need parties on both sides who are relatively coherent and somewhat unified. The regime is coherent and somewhat unified, the opposition right now is not. In fact, quite the opposite. They're quite fragmented. And most of the people with whom the West has been talking in terms of the opposition has been the external Syrian opposition, when in my reading of it, and many other people's reading of it, the real leadership, those who have credibility and legitimacy in the Syrian opposition, are those inside Syria doing the fighting and the dying. In my mind, at least, the world has, even in a diplomatic sense, has taken an outside-in approach to Syria, when in my view it should be an inside-out approach. And we just haven't done that to date. I think there are attempts to begin to do that. But this is going to take a long, long time. The Geneva process, in terms of a grand political bargain that was announced by the United States and Russia last May, it was almost a build it and they will come type of methodology, without doing the real necessary groundwork in terms of preparing the opposition and also making contacts with the regime, necessary contacts, and filling out their positions. And this takes a long time, and it's very tedious. And there are wonderful people out there who do this type of work. And I think the Western community, the UN, needed to do this much, much more before a political settlement can actually be discussed. And the big mistake from the very beginning in terms of diplomatically resolving this or getting some sort of political settlement was that everyone thought Assad would fall quickly. And so all of the diplomatic meetings, all of the academic conferences discussing the Syrian conflict, for at least a year, were always on what should come after Assad falls. Well, he hasn't fallen. So we're very much late in the game in trying to deal with a situation where this regime, which we expected to fall, isn't falling and may not fall anytime soon.
My guest is David W. Lash. He's professor of Middle East history at Trinity University and author of the book Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. David W. Lesh joins us today from the studios of Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. He's a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University and author of the book Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. It's just been newly updated following initial publication last year, and it's available now in a paperback version. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, David, many observers expected Assad to fall quickly. 2.5 years later, he is still hanging on. How much does Iran have to do with that?
Well, it has a lot to do with it. I think the most important factor is the cohesiveness at the top of the regime, particularly the military security apparatus, whereas in Egypt, Tunisia, and elsewhere, in Libya even, the military security apparatus disintegrated. But in Syria, it has largely remained intact. There have been defections, the rank and file, and some at the officer of the officer corps, but no real significant defections from the top of the hierarchy, either political, military, or security. So I think that's been a major reason why Assad has been able to stay in power, and just the fact that again, the ability of the regime to play off the fragmentation of the opposition to win in its own sense the war of narratives. And the narrative at the beginning was, that these are terrorists and jihadists and so forth. When at the start of the uprising, it wasn't. It was peaceful protesters that then evolved into a conflict, and now a civil war, and some civil wars within a civil war within Syria. But now that the conflict has, the country has been degraded so much, this is fertile territory for jihadists, and of course a number of groups and powerful groups have entered into to Syria. So it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy that the initial narrative of the Syrian regime seems to be coming to pass.
So there has been extraordinary bloodshed already, and regardless of who wins, they will have to deal with the more than 2 million at this point, right? Displaced people from Syria that at some point might wish to try to return to where they are. I mean, is an Assad backed by Iran in any position to do anything for them if peace takes place and he prevails?
That's a complex issue. It's going to be a generation before Syria, even if the war stopped today, it'll be a generation before Syria rebuilds and becomes, I think, stable again. A quarter of the country, well over 100,000 have died. You mentioned the 2 million that are refugees. There are over 4 million internally displaced persons inside Syria. So that's over a quarter of the population. And not to even speak of the destruction of factories and the psychology of a population that's been traumatized by this conflict, all of the other players that have entered into this conflict. It's going to be a very, very long time, no matter what happens. If there's a political settlement, if Assad drops off the face of the earth tomorrow, there's likely to be more conflict because, as I said earlier, there seem to be breaking out civil wars within a civil war. And there'll be this contest for power. And Syria has become, you've mentioned Iran a couple of times, it has become this regional proxy war between supporters of the Syrian regime, particularly Iran and Hezbollah, and supporters of the opposition, such as Saudi Arabia and the country of Qatar and Turkey. It's become this contest that has much more than a domestic dimension, has a regional and even an international dimension, because Russia and the United States have more often than not been on opposite sides of this conflict.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to George in Louisville on the phone. Hi, George.
Hi, Chris. Great topic today. Very close to my heart because I was born in Lebanon. The question is for Professor. Say Syria was in Lebanon like in the 70s and 80s, and they practically, destroyed the country. What is the connection between that and now what's happening in Syria?
Thanks for your call.
Well, the main connection, of course, as the caller, I'm sure very well knows, is Hezbollah. The Syrian entry into Lebanon in the mid-70s, in the midst of a Lebanese civil war, and Syria using that fragmentation in Lebanon to secure a dominant position for itself, certainly following the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, Syria, looking for allies, started to develop a relationship with Hezbollah, which built up in the mid-late 1980s. And also Hezbollah in Syria played off the connection both had with Iran, and Syria became this conduit for Iranian political and military support for Hezbollah. And so, the growth of Hezbollah has been, the most lasting and important feature of the Lebanese civil war of the 70s and 80s in my mind, result primarily due to the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982. And now, this building up this relationship with Hezbollah is paying dividends for the Syrian regime because Hezbollah, along with Iran, but Hezbollah has been intimately involved in the conflict in Syria, is sending its fighters, openly sending its fighters, and they've made a tactical difference on the battlefield in support of the Syrian regime.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have an email here from Rabin who asks, would you please comment on the current relationship of the Kurds with Assad and with the opposition?
It's a very complex relationship. The Kurds actually, and in my mind, have played it fairly wisely. They've kind of sat on the fence and not taken, at least for most Kurds, have not taken a position in total support of the opposition, have not taken a position in support of the regime. And therefore, you know, and they can't be called traitors or anything but the opposition, because the Kurds in Syria have paid their dues in Syria. You know, many retreated as non-citizens, and they experience some of the same prejudices and lack of access to services and upward social mobility that Kurds have in other countries, particularly in Turkey. So they can't be said to have been selling out. Yet the regime, in a fairly prudent move in its own regard, has essentially given Kurdish-dominated areas, particularly in the northeast of Syria, basic semi-autonomy, where they've in essence seem to be in the process of doing what the Kurds did in Iraq, in northern Iraq, and that is carving out an autonomous state, to the point where, you know, one of the big questions concerning all of this, concerning, you know, the Druze in the south, the Alawites, the Sunnis, the Kurds in Syria, is, you know, will Syria, you know, be able to reconstitute itself again at any point in the new future? Will it break up into a mini Syria that has regime or pro-regime elements, you know, around Damascus, in the center and south of Syria? Will an Alawite state develop in the northwest, where they originally came from and where many of them still live? Will a Kurdish autonomous zone be created? Will an opposition elements create mini fiefdoms? And many people, you know, they say, what's going to happen to Syria? And unfortunately, many, you know, see the disintegration of Syria into something like Somalia, with where you have warlords, dominating various smallish territories, and with a weakened regime, perhaps controlling, being the largest militia in essence in the country.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to George in Irving. Hi, George.
Hi, Chris. The great show.
Thank you.
Hi, Professor. My question was about what the U.S.'s role in this conflict, what the motivation is behind that role, because in other uprisings around the Middle East around the same time, 2011, 2010, say in Bahrain or Yemen, the U.S. didn't do anything. So why is it so important for the U.S. to be looking into what's going on in Syria all the time? Is it because of their geopolitical interests against Iran and Hezbollah and that sort of thing?
That's a good question. And, you know, it's hard to pin down what U.S. policy has been. They've taken a kind of episodic approach, a case-by-case approach to these uprisings in the Middle East, whereas they, you know, engaged militarily and led from behind, so to speak, in a NATO operation in Libya. As the caller said, in Bahrain, they did virtually nothing. And in Yemen, they helped work out a political deal with the Saudis. And in Egypt and Tunisia, they took at least diplomatic and action and economic action, and the ties that they had with the Tunisian military, and particularly with the Egyptian military. And that's one thing that the United States does not have with Syria, because Syria, of course, has been on opposite sides of the United States for most of its modern existence. So we didn't have the levers, economic levers, political, military levers on Syria to really affect too much change. And frankly speaking, I think the administration for some time just wished that the Syria conflict would go away, that at first that Bashar al-Assad would implement reforms and make some concessions that would defuse the uprising. That didn't happen. Then we were hoping for regional powers and the UN to develop some sort of a political settlement. That didn't happen. And again, as I mentioned earlier, the Obama administration, and again, not to criticize them for this, but, you know, they are very reluctant to engage in any sort of assertive military action. Yet, on the other hand, as the caller said, they've seen this as an opportunity. If they can get rid of the regime in Syria, it would be a blow to Iran and a blow to Hezbollah. So, you know, we're kind of in a conundrum where we want to take limited action in order to achieve our strategic objectives of overthrowing a regime that we don't particularly like, and it would be a blow to Iran and Hezbollah. You know, on the other hand, those very limited objectives aren't going to make much of a difference on the battlefield to help us reach our objectives. And then we don't want to take the actions such as direct military involvement that would, in fact, you know, change the regime, would in fact defeat the regime, because this could lead to an ownership of the results which we didn't very much like in Iraq or Afghanistan and a number of other places, as well as a slippery slope toward even more military intervention and possibly expanding the conflict. Because what would Iran do in that case? What would Hezbollah do? What would Russia do in terms of more assertively supporting the Syrian regime? Would the would we be able to contain the conflict that's already spreading across some of its borders? So there's no easy answer to this. And as in most cases, rather than taking one position and sticking with it, or on the opposite end of the spectrum, taking that position, we're trying to do something in the middle without really achieving either end.
Is Russian support of the regime more conditional than Iranian support?
Russian, to some extent. Iran plays, in my view, a much more central role in supporting the Syrian government, the Syrian regime. It has much more influence in Damascus than Russia has. Russian support is based on a number of different factors. The fact that they've had a long-standing relationship with Syria, the fact that they have a naval base, which they recently evacuated, but they have access to one in the Mediterranean, which is their only one in the area. But more so, I think it's almost a Russian nationalist position that President Putin has taken, in the sense that he does not want to give in to the United States on this issue. He does not want Syria to fall apart and have chaos come into being, and that could spread across the region. He doesn't want a jihadist state come into being in Syria that could affect radical Islamist groups that reside within Russian borders. So Russia has definite interests to support the Syrian regime. I don't think it's a blank check of support. Certainly, if these reports of the chemical attacks, if thousands were killed and if it can be proved that the Syrian regime was behind it, that's going to place Moscow in a very, very awkward position. And especially in the Security Council, where the United States and its allies will pressure them to finally accede to Security Council resolutions that may open the more doors for military support for the opposition.
David W. Lesh is professor of Middle East history at Trinity University. His book, Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad, has been newly updated following initial publication last year, and it's now available in paperback. David Lesh joined us from the studios of Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. David, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
It was my pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.